I'm Al Filreis, and this is Poem Talk at the Writer's House, where I have the pleasure of convening three friends in the world of contemporary poetry and poetics to collaborate on a close, but not too close, reading of a poem. We'll talk, maybe even disagree a bit, and perhaps open up the verse to a few new possibilities, and we hope gain for a poem that interests us, some new readers and listeners. And I say listeners because Poem Talk poems are available in recordings made by the poets themselves as part of our Penn Sound Archive, writing.upenn.edu/PennSound. Today, I'm joined here in Philadelphia at the Kelly Writer's House in our third floor Garrett studio by Julia Block, veteran of Bay Area independent progressive publishing at Tacoon, Curve, and other venues, a widely published poet, author of Post-Psychiatric Sonnets, whose wonderful reading with Dodie Bellamy in 2007 is featured prominently on her Penn Sound page, and who is the managing editor of Jacket 2. And by Lynn Din, Saigon-born Philadelphian, whose most recent book of poems is Some Kind of Cheese Orgy, published by Chax Press, and whose much-updated blog called State of the Union is full of, among other things, photographs perfectly capturing our economic mode. LinnDinPhotos.blogspot.com. And by Frank Sherlock, among whose many recent doings are the books The City Real and Imagined, written with C.A. Conrad, a psychogeographical Philadelphia poem, at least partly, and from 2009, Over Here, published by Factory School, and whose Penn Sound author page I highly recommend. Welcome back, all three of you, to Poem Talk. Lynn, hello.
How are you?
I'm great. It's good to see you. Frank and Julia, hello.
Hi, Al.
Good to see you. Everybody good today?
Yes, yes.
Good. Well, today our poem is Norman Fisher's I'd Like to See It, which was published in Turn Left in Order to Go Right by O Books in 1989. Our Penn Sound recording of the poem dates from 2006, so here now is Norman Fisher reading I'd Like to See It.
I'd Like to See It. A compendium of words was stored here just underneath the chimney. I'd like to see it that way. Fortune won't stand still for that. And pressure of the air flattens paper. I'd like to see it that way. One comes into the room, groomed a pleasure. There's a patch of glitter in the glamour. I'd like to see it that way. Each moment opens up sudden as an umbrella. On a day, storms gather like wool, a way I'd really like to see it. So you can't assume a face again before the non-face puts in its appearance. Nor can you push at the door expecting satisfaction on the other side. I'd like to see it that way. Many's the time and time for reflection. Truer than truth, the subject's interconnections. I'd like to see it that way. I was born on a day absolutely unique in world history. Birds grasp their path in air. I'd like to see it that way. It's standard to pack half a dozen at a clip. Imagine the red thing, yours, alone, at last. I'd like to see it that way. The image almost takes shape, superimposed as a mist on top of ordinary daily objects. I'd like to see it that way. Life goes on forever, like a dusty road down which we peer as we drink a glass of water. I'd like to see it that way. We return again and again, born into wombs the shape of inverted ice cream cones. I'd like to see it that way so I could relax, put on my enormous suit, and ring your doorbell holding my breath and flowers. I'd like to see it that way in order to be able to end war. But would war ever end, or would my wanting to end it ever end if nothing ever ended? I'd like to see it that way. Everything is standing up and falling down again, constantly like hair in wind. I'd like to see it that way. For the good of the nation, behind bars. For my own good, bundled up into piles. I'd like to see it that way. I blow continuously on this thing. The landscape crumples around me like a felt hat. I'd like to see it that way. But the problem is, I put out my hand and only clutch air, wanting to understand. I'd like to see it some way, anyway, so long as I could know it was there and could pull back the covers at will to reveal my heart's desire and measure it. I'd like to see it that way.
So why don't we start by talking about the refrain? How does the refrain work? What effect does it have? Is it deployed in different ways along the way? How does it sound to you? Lynn, thoughts?
Well, it happens pretty much every third line. So, and then he varies it. Frankly, I mean, it's very funny in the beginning, but it got to annoy me a little bit at the end because I was dreading to hear it again. But because it's he mixes it up, so you know,
does it
you don't know when it's coming.
Meaning functions. At the beginning, it simply seems to mean this is what I'd like things to be, but then it does other things. Frank, does it do other things?
I look at it at the way that Norman Fisher talks about language as and words as objects, and at the same time ephemeral. So you have this object that comes back time and time again, but in that way that is repeated is a different way each time. So it makes that line at the same time an object and ephemeral.
Can we anatomize that a little bit? So let's pick some instances of the refrain and say how it functions, how it means differently, any of them. Julia, do you have one?
Well, on the, several lines down, he writes, "Nor can you push at the door expecting satisfaction on the other side. I'd like to see it that way." So, "nor can you push at the door expecting satisfaction on the other side" is a pretty complicated line. It's got a lot of different conditionals, and it's sort of a line that's imagining something. And then, "I'd like to see it that way," I think both swerves away from the intention going on in that line, and also modifies it. It's pushing the imagined situation further at the same time that it's.
How would you translate
it
right there?
I'd like it to be the case that you cannot push at the door, expecting satisfaction, expecting to find something on the other side that's better than what we have now.
Great. Okay, so that's one way it functions. Frank, can you think of another example?
Sure, we can compare the first three lines. "A compendium of words was stored here, just underneath the chimney. I'd like to see it that way."
Yeah.
And coming back to the idea of the word as an object, and yet underneath the chimney, which means it's, for me, it's ready for the fire, ready to become smoke, ready to take a new form. And then a little bit down further.
Oh, so that way, I'm sorry, so that way means I'd like to have that perspective on it.
Right.
That way, as opposed to this way or another way.
Well, that's how I'm seeing it.
Okay, good.
And then that way becomes different further down in the poem when he says, "I was born on a day absolutely unique in world history. Birds grasp their path in air. I'd like to see it that way." And I think there he's using it as the authenticity of the moment. So I think it's serving a very different function.
"Many's the time and time for reflection. Truer than truth, the subject's interconnections. I'd like to see it that way. I was born on a day absolutely unique in world history. Birds grasp their path in air. I'd like to see it that way."
Lynn, can you give us an example toward the end of an annoying version of the refrain?
Well,
so we can actually
just because he repeated it so many times,
right?
And I see this. I mean, I like this poem.
So, I'm sure you do. Is there a spot where it's a throwaway line and not necessary? Would you say?
It's a very playful poem, and there are many lines that are kind of like little jokes. You know, "I was born in a day absolutely unique in world history" is kind of funny, and I like that, and I like what you mentioned, expecting satisfaction on the other side. I mean, it's funny, but I like to see the refrain itself is kind of a little joke, but it happens, so many times that I kind of dread is, returning towards the end is all I'm saying. And, it's good when he gives it a little bit more room, like he waits a few more lines for it to repeat itself.
Mm-hmm.
That's all.
I chose for us to talk about Norman Fisher in part because I admire his work as a whole. And I'm interested in the question of whether there's a Zen Buddhistic aesthetic, whether his Zen practice or his meditative practice, which for him is, and he's written about it and talked about it a lot, so it really is a way of changing at the time, I guess it's the mid-70s or late-70s, changing the way he writes so that he's present-focused. All right, so we can talk about that more. But so I chose this poem, not really in detail thinking about it as an example of that, but really hoping that we would almost accidentally be able to talk about whether there is a Zen aesthetic here. Just assuming that there is, to the extent that there is, what would you say, Frank?
Well, I can say in terms of the repetition of that line, it can serve as a meditation.
It is meditative.
In that way, that you're returning to that line, but the moment is different each time that you return to that line. And Fisher has talked about unintentionally having his religious practice coming through his work, his poetics, while at the same time viewing them as two very different practices over time, that he has noticed that on some level he needed to embrace that because...
But I'd like to see it that way, at least conventionally, Lynn says, what I have now is not the way I'd like to see it. Or it could mean the way I'm seeing it in those lines is the way I'd like the world to be, which happens to be the way it is because I observed it. One way or other, it strikes me that there is a difference between the way the world is and the way the world is if he were able to see it the way he'd like to. That suggests a discomfort with the world rather than living in the present. Have I overinterpreted that?
Okay. Would war ever end, or would my wanting to end it ever end? If not, see, the nothing is interesting to me, because instead of saying if anything ever ended, you know, nothing ever ended. So in a sense, he answered the question. War will never end because nothing ever ended. But then his wanting of it is also
never ending. I'd like
never
to
ending.
See it that way. What right. is it? Or in the context of wanting war to end, what does it mean to say I'd like to see it that way?
But then he answered it, because nothing ever ended, right? So war will never end.
That's a problem.
Yes. Right, and right. that's, yeah, that that contradiction, he sees it as it being very public at with its admission as not being so confusing in his everyday. Because I would say it would be, because he's spoken about this line, more than once, to be without content but full of light. Right. And I'm seeing it as that light, that consciousness. And that is a toward.
It's almost
unfulfilled.
Like, it's almost like the it is being put into the form of the line, which I've also heard Norman Fisher talk about the poetry in that way. It's each line puts the present moment into a form and then immediately moves on to the next form. All these forms are ephemeral. And I really like thinking about how these lines are leading to each other, even as disjunctive as they might seem. I mean, every time this refrain comes in, it's doing something different, and sometimes it follows more than it follows other moments.
It's also causing him to stop and reorient.
Right.
Right, so it separates... simple present observations or thoughts, calls himself up short. In that sense, it becomes meditative, and almost Lynn doesn't mean what it means. It's almost more of a breathing in or a taking stock.
Which is all about being present. I'd like to see it that way. I'd like to see it that way. I'd like to see it that way. I'd like to see it that way.
All those ways.
Well, it's like a marker for him to pivot away from what he just said, you know? And,
yeah.
And in a sense, this kind of paratactic strategy is fairly standard these days, right? We all do that now, right? Especially in our camp or whatever. So you can call it a kind of a jazz aesthetic or Zen aesthetic, but it's also like a television aesthetic, you know, because it's like I see it that way.
Ooh,
it's kind of a commercial,
fighting words.
A commercial break, so you can like return to the program.
Wow. Who's going to respond to that? I mean, it is true that Norman Fisher, when he talks about he was away from Taiwan for 16 or 17 years. He came back, and only then, he says, discovered that he had compadres in the language poetry movement who weren't doing, in terms of personal practice, what he's doing. In fact, the conversation he has with Charles Bernstein is hilarious, because Bernstein's all about maintaining his anxieties in order to continue to produce. And Norman is saying, he's not proselytizing Buddhistic practice. He's just saying, I do something different. But in fact, Fisher would say they end up with the same result. He found affinities with the so-called language school, which suggested to me, yippee, I don't have to meditate in order to... Frank, your thought.
in terms of the idea of Zen poetry and thinking about Buddhist poetry, American Buddhist poetry is very very different than traditional Buddhist poetry, which is very structured and
traditional.
And traditional, yeah. So when you think of the tradition of American Buddhist poetry, it's had that sort of avant-garde associations and
to jazz, for instance,
particularly post-war jazz. So totally see that. But in terms of his affinity with the language poets, I see it as that that idea of words as objects, and but also in terms of Fischer's own form. Where Zen informs his form, I think, is the idea of being grounded in silence, and that the use of language is profound when that silence is broken.
Life goes on forever like a dusty road down which we peer as we drink a glass of water. I'd like to see it that way. We return again and again, born into wombs the shape of inverted ice cream cones. I'd like to see it that way so I could relax. Put on my enormous suit and ring your doorbell, holding my breath and flowers. I'd like to see it that way in order to be able to end war. But would war ever end, or would my wanting to end it ever end if nothing ever ended? I'd like to see it that way.
I think improvisation is really important to him. He talks about that deriving from jazz, and he has found Zen practice to be a way of reminding himself always that what he's doing is only valuable, not as content, as you made the distinction before, or quoting him made the distinction, but as something that's ephemeral, that's present, that's passing. And he says, I don't know if this is true, but he says his hope is not to create a line that's memorable. His hope is to create
an instance of the present.
Right. Well, maybe in his heart of hearts, he wouldn't mind coming up with something that's memorable, but that would theoretically defeat the purpose of improvisation. Well, let's look at a comic moment, an antic moment. I think it's antic. I could relax, put on my enormous suit, and ring your doorbell, holding my breath and flowers. I'd like to see it that way. What's he doing there? Is that just
that,
sentimentality?
I think that's the point of him breaking that silence. With that sound, ringing the doorbell, and bringing.
But isn't it some kind of cliche romantic moment that he's? It's a bit of a Hallmark card, isn't it?
We're playing right into Lynn's hands.
Seems really self. We could read it as really self-deprecating. Well, you know, we return again and again, born into womb. So I can take this. I can make this gesture. I can take this romantic risk and show up in an enormous suit, and then that's followed by ending war. So it's a very, in the structure of the poem, it's a funny moment, not funny haha, but a little bit awkward.
I think there are many funny moments in this, right? Imagine a red thing, yours alone at last. That's hilarious, right?
When Fischer was interviewed by Robert Front, he was asked about his spiritual practice and his poetry and the connection, and he said, and I'll quote it and ask for your comments, he described his writing before he discovered his practice. And that writing became unsatisfactory, he said, because the idea of writing about experience that had already happened, rehashing old experiences, seemed too intellectual and too artificial. So he wanted a writing that would be a discovery in the present world. He found that writing about life that had happened before was bad for life and bad for writing. So, again, he focused his writing on the present moment and improvisation. Does that distinction make sense to you? Is it attractive to you? Does it hold up?
Well, except for the line, I was born on a day absolutely unique in world history, I think, right? The whole poem is about the present and the future. It's all about what's happening now, what might happen, and what could happen. So it seems like there's that one moment that happens in the past, and then it gets immediately shifted to birds grasp their path in air. It goes immediately to this very airy image in the sky.
What if I'd like to see it that way was almost entirely ironic?
I don't know. You're saying that the implication is I'd like to see it that way, but I don't?
Or no, I already do.
Oh, but I already do. Okay.
I think there's a kind of wryness to his tone, you know. I mean, he's fairly resigned, I would say. So I don't think I like to see it that way. has that much weight, really. You know what I'm saying? It's just, it's a little, like I say, it's a little joke almost. You know what I'm saying?
Resigned.
He doesn't mean it, okay?
Yeah, I agree that he doesn't mean it, but resigned? I sense at ease, lightness, peace. Not peace at the fact that he can't end war and that war can't be ended, but peace at some kind of recognition of the situation.
Do you sense some detachment in him at all?
I do.
I'm wondering, Lynn, were you as annoyed by the refrain when you heard the recording, or was it more on the page
on the page.
Because the way I'm wondering what you thought of the way he reads it, because he reads it so sonorously and really presently, actually, every time it repeats.
And I'm assuming that he probably reads it differently each time, because mm-hmm. he didn't he slow over some of these line breaks.
I think you're right.
He paused quite dramatically in the middle, you know, where the punctuation doesn't call for it. So, so he probably improvises each time he reads this poem. So mm-hmm. I was quite surprised, because I didn't hear the recording until just now.
I blow continuously on this thing. The landscape crumples around me like a felt hat. I'd like to see it that way, but the problem is I put out my hand and only clutch air, wanting to understand. I'd like to see it some way, anyway, so long as I could know it was there and could pull back the covers at will to reveal my heart's desire and measure it. I'd like to see it that way.
It strikes me that when I read Norman Fisher's poems, and when I listen to him talk about the poems when I read him writing about it, that he is the opposite of proselytizing his process. He really doesn't want to come on like somebody who has the way and you should find the way at all, which is what, for me, is finally so beautiful about the work. Well, let's go around and get final thoughts on the poem before we gather some paradise, make some recommendations. Final thoughts, something we haven't said yet that you think needs saying. Frank, Sherlock?
Well, talking about Norman Fisher, of course, I think of Philip Whalen. We had a close friendship, and Philip Whalen was a mentor to him of sorts. But in the terms of that refrain, I also think of that, you know, that famous Whalen quote, the continuous nerve movie that just keeps coming back. But it's a different image each time.
Thank you. Julia Block, final thought.
At the end of the poem, Norman Fisher writes, "But the problem is I put out my hand and only clutch air, wanting to understand." And I'm really struck by those two lines. First of all, they rhyme, which is very rare for this poem. And then there's this problem. And I'm left wondering what that problem is. Is it the desire for understanding and for knowledge and for being able to analyze this moment, this moment of living? Or is it what sometimes in the classroom we call a productive problem, a problem that produces meaning and produces knowledge? And I really like that image of clutching air.
It seems to undo my reading of the refrain as ironic in this sense, that desire is severed from its object, wanting something, a solution or an object, and then coming away from that, reaching out of the hand and finding that it's empty. It's actually not empty. There's air in it, but understanding still remains to be had. So you can't have or possess understanding. Mm-hmm. You simply want to reach out with desire and get an object, and then, of course, you're going to find out that there is no answer.
It's like that bird whose path is in the air. You can't see the path. It's just the bird flying through the air.
It is. And I'd like to see it. Normally you'd get there, I'd like to see it that way, meaning I'd like to see this kind of practice be the practice of desire, where you still desire but don't get anything in return that's objective. And then it's, I'd like to see it some way.
Right.
There's a slight, desperation? Some way, anyway.
Right.
That's quite nice. Lyndin, final thought.
I'm just wondering a bit about the tone of this poem, which is...
you said resigned before.
Well, it's also ironic and fairly detached, you know, and it's a fairly familiar approach these days. And I'm wondering, you know, why that is, and whether you can infuse poetry with... more hysterical emotions, but retaining the light, you know what I'm saying? And not get stupid and silly and indulgent and turn people off. Well, maybe you should turn people off. I take that back. Maybe that's not such a so bad. But there's something too very civilized about this poem, right? And I mean, that's the strength. Maybe it's a question of temperament. I'm wishing so for some stronger medicine.
He makes a content light distinction. Frank, what was the line about content and light?
Oh, to be without content, but full of light.
Okay, so content, no, light, yes. And the rejection of content, I think you're saying in a way, the rejection of content can be had without necessarily the light, which is a sort of a floaty detachment.
Well,
there are alternatives to the alternative to content.
More heat, more dirt or something, you know? But maybe I'm just maybe I'm just stating my own preference.
Well, that can be your mantra, okay? No content, only dirt. Well, we like to end Poem Talk with a minute or two of Gathering Paradise, which means we do the Dickinsonian thing of gathering in paradise with our narrow hands. But Frank doesn't have narrow hands. He has big hands. So you want to tell us something about something in the poetry world you like?
Sure. I'd like to talk a little bit as a seg from Zanon Poetry about a new book from Deborah Morkin called Project Machine from Blaze Vox Books. She is a Naropa alumnus and living in Philadelphia and part of the New Philadelphia Poets and a fantastic poet. So
great.
Check her out.
Thank you, Frank. Julia.
I've been really enjoying another psychogeographical Philadelphia poem, which is Kevin Verone's Pashunk Lost, which came out from Ugly Duckling
Press. Another Philadelphian.
And it is getting me acquainted with a neighborhood that's new to me, which is South Philadelphia, which is a great part of the city and a very long and complicated street there.
What is it about all these psychogeographical poems coming out of Philadelphia? Frank, can you explain this fashion?
Well, we live here, and we're writing our way through the
and
city.
And we have a psyche, and there is a geography.
There you go.
Okay. Well, that's all the Seeing It That Way we have time for on Poem Talk today. Poem Talk at the Writer's House is a collaboration of the Center for Programs in Contemporary Writing and the Kelly Writer's House at the University of Pennsylvania and Poetry Foundation, poetryfoundation.org. Thanks to my guests, Frank Sherlock, Lynn Dinh, and Julia Block, and to Poem Talk's engineer today, Steve McLaughlin, and to our editor, as always, the self-same Steve McLaughlin. Next time on Poem Talk, Josephine Park, Herman Beavers, and Tracy Morris converge here to talk about Etheridge Knight's poem reply to Gwendolyn Brooks. This is Al Filreis, and I hope you'll join us for that or another Poem Talk.